Good morning, one and all. Hello, how are we all doing? I'm just moving around the room a little bit, trying out different positions. Come on in, welcome. We have spare sheets here. Is Eric back? Not yourself, no problem. So we've had some... Firstly, welcome everybody. Good morning, welcome back to those who've been away. Thank you for staying, all those who haven't. We've had some very busy parashiyot, split into lots of different sections and lots of different spaces. If you were staging the play, as we've said, that has been staged about the story of Joseph, you'd have a lot of flashing to different geographies, different rooms, different topographies. What we have in this week's parasha is actually relatively straightforward. There are only really two acts here. The first is Joseph's revelation, meaning he reveals himself to his brothers, and the second is the descent of Yaakov. Those are really the two primary acts. There are some details along the way, the mechanics of how Joseph reveals himself, what causes him to reveal himself, then the discussion with Yaakov and the trip down along the way, and one, of course, if one's following rabbinic interpretation, you have a lot more story to talk about, stopping along the way, the conversations that happen, the people that engage, the characters you'd have to involve. It becomes quite complicated. But just the plain reading is this is relatively simple. You've got a revelation of Joseph, the descent of Jacob to come and meet his son. I wanted to do a little overview of some of the details along the way just to give us a fuller picture. And then we're going to look at the text. And I've got a pasuk on the sheet to focus on as well with some interesting avenues to explore. So let's start from the beginning. What's the week parasha called? Vayigash, helpful. What does Vayigash mean? And he
approached.
Okay. One makes an approach. What does that mean, to approach someone? Just on the basic level, what does approaching someone mean? Well, that's certainly one way to read it, but just the mechanics of it means, I mean, in the most simple, pared-down sense, it means you're moving towards somebody. Which triggers all sorts of questions. Why is Judah moving at all? The previous parsha, Miketz, finishes, they're standing right with each other, they're in conversation already. Yehuda's speaking. What can I say? How can I justify myself? Chalilali, it would be sacrilegious to do that. They're in conversation. Our parsha begins again. We're used to a mentality when each week is a separate chapter. Okay, new play. But in that, they're in the middle of a conversation. V'yigash elav Yehuda, and Judah approaches him. So they wonder, why? What is the aim? What is the tenor? What is the tone? How do I picture this? How do I paint this? How do I portray this if I'm making a play or a movie? How do I plot this scene? Why is he moving forward? And it helps us to see what Judah actually said. Vayomer, and Judah says, I apologize, you don't have this on the sheet, it's in the Chumash, or you could just listen. Vayomer, be Adoni, please, my master. Already, what kind of tone do we sense? Deference, subservience. He's certainly submitting himself to the power of this figure whose identity he doesn't seem to know. Of course, all it takes is, as I mentioned, in the text, it's very hard to read tone. All it takes is a little emoji to see this sarcastic. Be Adonai, oh please, my master. Right? Meaning this could be sarcasm. It would be risky. It would be strange for Yehuda to do that in this dynamic, but it's possible. Yad berna avdecha davar ba'zne Adonai, please, my master, may I say something in your ear? Where else are you going to say it? Why is he saying, can I say something in your ear? Maybe he wants to whisper. Why is he going to whisper? He doesn't want anyone to hear. What, this is a secret? We're getting a strange sense here where they're in the middle of conversation and something shifts. In the middle, Judah says, okay, something isn't working here. I need to change gears. He approaches him. He's asking to say something in his ear. Of course, it doesn't have to mean whisper. What else might it mean? Can I say something in your ear? It might just mean, can I make a personal appeal, right? Let me, give me your ear. Who was it who said that? Caesar? Lend me. He gave him back, of course. He said, just lend me your ears with interest. Yeah, it was quite, lend me your ears. Romans, countrymen, Thank you. Friends. I forgot the friends. Well, they stabbed him, so they weren't nearly that friendly. Please do not become angry with your servant. Ki chamocha kefaro, because you are like Pharaoh. So the theme appears to continue. Subservience, deference. He is submitting. You can imagine if you were to picture this, if you had two actors on stage and Judah said, how do you want me to portray the scene? What would you tell them to do? Meaning we're not told how they're standing, what their postures are. What would you tell Judah to do if you were directing?
Grovel.
Bow on your knees. Please, my master. And if you search on Google, Joseph's revelation to the brothers, most of the paintings you'll find are with Judah down on his knees, begging. To Joseph, to this viceroy, saying, please, let me say something in your ear. Don't be angry. I'm your master. Now, another way to figure out what Vayigash means, this approach, is not just from the local context, but where else the word appears in the Chumash. Where else does this verb have purchase? And it seems to be that there are various ways in which it's used. And I'll begin because the Malbim, the most important figure in Jewish history, obviously, somebody will read my dissertation when I finish it, says this entire scene speaks to this subservience because of something we're all quite used to. He says there are two ways to get justice in a structured civilization. What are the two avenues for justice, two institutions for justice? Think of separation of powers. How many branches are there? Three branches in this country. How many of them supervise the adjudication of justice?
Two
we have. Any advance on two?
One.
Two. Well, one would seem to be obvious from its name. What's the name of that branch? Judiciary. You go to court, you have a hearing, and you get a verdict. You said two. Which is the second branch?
The legislature can overrule the courts.
The legislator can overrule the courts? Is that true? I don't know. In what way?
Establish laws.
Oh, okay. So I don't know if it can overrule, but it can do a workaround, right? Yeah. Meaning if the court rules this is unconstitutional, the legislature, in theory, can have a constitutional amendment, and it wouldn't quite overrule it, but it would reset the ground. There is another branch that can overrule the courts. The executive can overrule the courts, not just at whim, and not in civil cases, but when does the executive have the power to overrule the courts? In criminal cases. And it's not quite overruling.
Clemency.
Right. You have pardon power. And there are ways that you pardon which expunges the result. You can't overturn a verdict and say they're innocent, they're not guilty, but you can expunge the record. Or you can just, what's it called when you let them out, but you don't change the record? So the pardon actually gets rid of, oh, you're right, pardon doesn't get rid of it, just gets rid of the punishment. But there is another way. I can't remember what it's called.
Commutation.
Yeah, commutation, when you commute the sentence. I can't remember exactly the differences. Either way, the executive is involved. And the Malbim, in the 1800s, in the 19th century, which is happily a century off to confuse us when we're talking about history, 19th century, 1800s, tells us that this is exactly what Yehuda shifts gears in. Last week's parsha, he was trying the case in court. And he says, Benjamin didn't do this. There's no way he would do this. There's not enough evidence. And Joseph is saying, I wouldn't do this if I didn't think I was right. Verdict, guilty. So Judah thinking, okay, they didn't quite have separation of powers in Egypt. They just had different modes in which the leader operated. They said, I'm not going to win on an evidentiary basis. You've got a case. The goblet was in his bag. V'yigashe lav Yehuda. Judah then approaches him, Joseph, as the leader, not in the court looking for a verdict, but as a executive looking for a pardon. V'yigashe lav Yehuda. He comes and says, Bi Adoni navdechad basne, please can I appeal to you? In your ear, I'm speaking to you, please hear me out. Ki chamocha kefaro, because you are like Pharaoh. This isn't just hyperbole to say, oh, you're wonderful, you're glorious. The sun shines out of your ears, you're amazing. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, you are empowered like Pharaoh to commute this sentence, to give me a pardon. He's begging for clemency. He says, I can't win in court, I'm begging you for a pardon. That's what Yehuda seems to be doing for the Malbim, which is one way of reading Vayigash, again, in this deferential way. At the same time, the Midrashim abound on this scene in terms of what happens. Vayigash is used in another context, which is war, combat.
It's used four times in the story of Yaakov meeting Esav for that reconciliation, hopefully.
Right.
And it's almost like it's a very tentative, kind of fearful. It's an encounter. There's something more going on than just meeting with somebody.
Right. Vayigash is not just to meet. Vikrav can mean to approach. That happens in the case of the Bnot Slofchad. Vikravu, they draw near. Vigash has a particular tone. It's certainly got an intimation of potential violence. Vigash, it's more of a clash than just a meeting, an encounter. And as you say, it appears already in the text in that way. And the Midrashim suggest here that Yehuda is incredibly aggressive. Despite the fact that he said, Ki chamocha kafaro, Rashi actually, already quoting Midrash, suggests that there's a double entendre when he says, because you are like Pharaoh. He's not just saying, you're as great as Pharaoh. Anyone remember what Rashi suggests he's hinting at? Excellent. I mentioned it in the Surah Shishir about a month ago. Moses Mendelssohn suggests that this is how we differentiate Pshat and Midrash. Because Pshat and Drash became exceptionally contentious in the 19th century when the rationalists were making fun of the rabbis. Because what did the rabbis say at this scene? The rabbis, I'll tell you what the Midrashim say. The Midrashim says, Yehuda at this point started shrieking with anger. He stamped his foot on the ground and the pillars of the Egyptian palaces began to crumble. And he was so angry that blood started dripping from his eyes. For some reason, he's wearing armor in the picture of some of this Midrashim. And the hair on his chest burst through the armor. And the other brothers started grinding iron with their teeth till it became dust. And all the teeth of the Egyptian soldiers fell out. And Joseph's sitting there on his throne and everything's beginning to crumble. Egypt's beginning to quake. That's the Midrash. And the rationalists are looking at this text. I'm looking at the Midrash and thinking, boy, those guys were on something. Well, what are they talking about? He says, you're like Pharaoh. May I say something in your ear? Be Adonai, please, my master. And the sage is desperate to try and rescue an image of a powerful Jew. Judah is the king. He's the figure of Jewish monarchy. And they're desperate to find a way to make him seem strong. So they invent all this stuff. But look at the pshat. The drash is crazy. And Moses Mendelssohn is the first modern Jew to try to confront this fissure between different ways of reading, and he tries to bring it together and says, actually, it's quite possible when we're speaking to have different audiences in mind when we're speaking. And on the pshat, he's speaking in front of the court saying, please, he's being deferential, being subservient, but actually there's a targeted message for Yosef or the viceroy, ki chamocha kafaro, you are no different to Pharaoh. And what happened to Pharaoh when Abraham and Sarah came down? What happened to him? Anyone remember? Leprosy. He got some sort of disease. And no doubt the current Pharaoh is familiar with pharaoic history. I say pharaoic, I think I mentioned this. Actually, pharaonic is the word, but no one knows what you're talking about. You say pharaonic. But pharaoic sounds better. And he's familiar with the annals of Egyptian history, and he knows what happens to Pharaoh when Jews come down. And Judah's saying to Yosef, Ki chamocha kafaro, you're no different to Pharaoh, which is, to the crowd, oh, he's being deferential. To the educated leader, he's thinking, oh, this is a subtle warning. And that is what Mendelssohn says, Chazal, the sages are picking up on, that latent threat, that aggression here. Obviously, what happened historically in this scene? If you were staging this scene, you would have Judah on his knees. But you would have this inner resilience. It wouldn't just be begging on the floor, flat out, breathless. There is an inner strength and resolve to this begging, almost, which Chazal are trying to bring out from the text. And in fact, the Rabbeinu Bachya says, V'yigash has three meanings. It can either mean war, it can mean appeasement, or it can mean law. And it appears in all three ways throughout Tanakh. And he says, which one did Yehuda intend? All three. That's what Rabbeinu Bachya says. That's what Judah's got. He's there inhabiting this ambiguous space. V'yigash, he's approaching the leader of this country, and he's ready. He begins in a mode of appeasement, please. But he hasn't given in. He's still got the strength to say, I'm willing to adjudicate this legally, and I'm willing to fight for this if you want. And that's all in this Vayigash, and it's quite fitting with something I mentioned about 2 months ago in Idrasha, a quote from John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill, anyone familiar with the name John Stuart Mill? He was a British philosopher, economist, thinker, who at a very young age was incredibly well-educated. By 5, he was reading Greek. By 7, he was reading Latin. He was familiar with all the classics. By 20, he actually had a mental breakdown because his father had pummeled him with education to the point where he just, it broke him almost. And actually, he writes about what revived him was romantic poetry. Romantic poetry, not like roses are red, violets are blue, I love you, la-di-da. The poet of the romantics, of Wordsworth and Shelley and Byron, that what revived him. And Isaiah Berlin, anyone heard of Isaiah Berlin, the name? He was also a British philosopher, Jewish, in fact. He was cremated, but he specifically requested a eulogy from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, I think, did give a eulogy for him about a month later in a memorial service. And Isaiah Berlin describes John Stuart Mill's education as an appalling success. That's the way he terms it. It was an appalling success, meaning he became educated. He knew everything, but it was appalling the way that he was educated. And John Stuart Mill has this phrase. It says, "War is an ugly thing, but it is not the ugliest of things. Uglier still is thinking there is nothing worth fighting for." That's John Stuart Mill, that war is ugly, but it's uglier to think that there is nothing worth fighting for. And the truth is, many of you probably don't feel this way, but I know a lot of the young men, at least that I've spoken to in YU in my time, and my peers as well, the sense that we'd be willing to fight physically. Israel is a different story. Everyone goes to the army. But the idea that conscription would be something people would be jumping to do is foreign to a lot of people. We take for granted the fact that there are people posted out there. What was it that... a few good men, the people out on the wall offering the protection. We take for granted that that's the case. And people are unwilling to think about the possibility of sacrifice, of going to war, fighting. And I know some of you were probably in the army. Any of you in the army at any point? All right, there you go. I know you're not that old, but some of you may have volunteered. Who knows? All right, so I'm talking to a young, spirited audience. The Peloponnesian War. You remember the Persians and the Greeks. Those of you who've seen the movie 300 will be familiar with that. But it's something we take for granted that people fight for us, and specifically at this time, when we are at a heightened state of sensitivity, of concern, feeling threatened, I think it's important to bear in mind v'yigash what Yehuda does, who, of course, we're called Jews because of Judah, that we approach this issue in a number of ways, one of which is going to be that we are willing to stand up. We're not just going to fall over. But obviously, we should be presenting ourselves in an articulate way, in a sophisticated way, in a strategic, tactical way, but also understand that while fighting is ugly, that we're not just going to fall over, and we are willing to stand up. And we're willing to give voice, and we're willing to fight. And that's what Chazal is seeing in this scene, that Judah, that Jews, as an image, but Yigash, the way that we approach things is not simple. It's not straightforward. And we do come with an appeal. But don't read that appeal as weak. Don't think that appeal doesn't have an inner resilience and inner strength. Okay, so that's the opening to the parasha. He then tells his story. He says, Mr. Viceroy, let me remind you, you asked us if we had a father. I said we had a father. We went to get him, and he didn't want to send the young son. We then had to bring him down, and now you're accusing him. This is not going to go well for us. Joseph, we're told, couldn't withstand anymore. He gave in. He sent everybody out the room. I'm going to talk about that particular scene on Shabbat morning. He sent everybody out of the room. He then reveals himself. Why didn't the brothers recognize him? Anyone remember? Right, Rashi says because he had a beard. That's why they didn't recognize him. It can change everything. But now he reveals himself. He says, oh, right, now I just see you have a beard. They recognize Joseph. Joseph cries with Benjamin. He then cries with everybody else individually. And the voice, it says, "Vahakol nishma l'chol beit paro," and the voice traveled around the house of Pharaoh. What voice? Right, so kol can mean voice literally. It could also mean the story, the news. so to speak. In fact, when the sages talk about kol, they're talking about rumors. If there's a rumor going on, if there's a kol on this issue, does it impact any halachic reality? So kol means the story traveled around, people heard. The Midrash actually says, v'hakol nishma, what was the voice? It was the shrieking of Judah. Everyone suddenly got worried that there was an attack because they heard shouting and aggression. But the simple reading is people heard that the brothers had come. Chief Rabbi Mervis has a small Dvar Torah every week he puts out, and it says v'hakol nishma, and hakol is spelled hey kuf lamed without a vav. And he suggests that actually this was a very quiet voice. Again, he's trying to kind of tampen down this scene that Joseph and the brothers are having a very quiet, genial exchange, and the news got round. And he used this to suggest that we don't have to shout to get a message heard. We just have to be direct and honest. So Yosef then sends the brothers on their way, says, go and get your father. He asks this very odd question after he reveals himself. He said, so is my father still alive? Why is that an odd question to ask? They've been talking about him all the time. That was one of the first things the brothers said when they came back. Their father's alive. Yehuda had been saying that in his whole recounting. He's been talking about his father. And Yosef says, is he still alive? It's very strange. Why would he ask that? Right, so one way to see it is the cover's off, the veil's down. I'm asking you honestly, is my father still alive? That wasn't a front. That's what I've been caring about this whole time. So he sends the brothers on their way. He appears to fall into the same trap that his father did. He gives all the brothers clothes and money and food, but he gives Binyamin five times the amount of everybody else. How is that not a show of favoritism? Or is it a show of favoritism? Is this an endemic capacity that human beings have to repeat the mistakes of the past? There are all technical ways it's been resolved. Oh, well, Binyamin was getting paid back because he had less from last time. Maybe he deserves more because he didn't do the selling of Joseph, all sorts of things. But on the face of it, he seems to be showing preferential treatment.
Rather than the other ones.
Say again?
He is more of a brother.
Right, he's biologically, genetically, he's more related. But again, I'm not sure that goes down well at the Thanksgiving gathering. But that's his reasoning. He sent, yeah.
Also, he's not the Bechor.
Whom?
Benjamin.
Yeah, it's a very... It's certainly conspicuous to give more to Binyamin. But I guess they understand. They understand... But also it haunts them because the brothers never truly believe that Yosef has forgiven them. Right at the end of next week's parasha, Vayechi, the end of Bereishis, after Yaakov passes away, they still think, they basically lie.
They have nothing to do with each other anymore, supposedly.
They go their separate ways and they lie to Joseph saying, oh, Dad said that really you should forgive us after he passes away. We have no evidence that he said that. It's possible he did off the pages of the Chumash, but they're hyper-concerned all the time that Joseph... It's impossible, they think, that he can forgive us. We remember what we did to him. We can't forget how we felt in that moment. We can't get rid of the remorse that we have. How is he taking this so well? And what does Joseph say at this moment? He says, oh, you sent me down for evil, but God turned it into good. So don't worry about it. And they keep thinking, I don't buy this. This guy's too good. There's got to be an incentive. There's got to be something suspicious. It's hard to believe that people can be so good, so virtuous. And the brothers don't fully believe him until the end. Either way, he sends them off. And maybe they see this gesture to Binyamin as a little insinuation that maybe they're right. Maybe he doesn't fully forgive them. So he sends them back. They get to Yaakov. They tell Yaakov, Joseph is alive and he's leader of Egypt. Says, oh boy, Yaakov's heart melts. He's stunned by the news. He doesn't know how to deal with it. And then he sees all the wagons coming and the news, and he says, okay, I buy this. Why do the wagons make him believe anything? Right, so the Midrash says they were learning about Agalot in their last time they had a Chevrusa. Again, this is where the rationalists of the 19th century say these rabbis are off their rocker. What are they talking about? That they were learning Chevrusa Mishnayos about Agalim. Why did the Agalim help Yaakov think that this is true? just on the pshat, the surface level. Because they went down to Egypt, why should they get preferential treatment? They're foreigners, and they're coming back laden with all this stuff. It must be true that somebody there favors them. Why would anyone do that? It must be that it's beginning to click into place. But again, the sages say it's more than that. It can't just be preferential treatment. It's awakening an inner memory about the past. And actually what they're directing us to do, Chazal, is to think about the relationship that they had. And the fact that Yosef and Yaakov have this familiarity, and he says, yeah, I've not actually let go of the past, and maybe my incapacity to let go, to be comforted and consoled, is because he hasn't gone. Maybe Yosef is still here.
So also that thing is that when the brothers came back this time, they came out with much greater abundance and more knowledge than when they returned the first time. Then they came with their pekolach, in a sense, from Egypt.
Right.
And now they're coming with all of this. How could that be the difference from before to now?
Right. It must be that Joseph has revealed himself and I want to go see them. And then in the middle, he just says, Harav. So he says, Rav, this is enough. O Joseph, ben Ichai, Joseph, my son, is alive. El Chav, Erenu b'terem amud, I must go see him before I die. He says, Rav, enough. I must go down. Why is he saying enough? In the middle, the brothers are recalling, Joseph's in charge of Egypt, he's alive, and Yaakov's response, Rav, enough, the son, my son Joseph is alive. Again, how are you staging this thing? Right, you say, okay, no more chat. One way to say it's okay, enough, you don't need to catch me up, I don't need to hear any more story, you talk to me while the Uber's arriving, just order it, get it done, we need to get on the way. That's one way to read it. And none of the commentators say, actually, Rav, enough is in a response directly to what the brothers had said. The brothers in the previous pasuk had said, Od Yosef Chai, Joseph is still alive, Yechihu Moshal B'chol Eretz Mitzrayim, and he's the leader of whole Egypt. And Yaakov is saying, Rav, you got me at hello, right? Meaning, all I needed to know was he's alive. Lovely, he's in charge of Egypt, I don't care. He's alive, that's all that matters to me. This has never been about my ambition. I never loved him because of the dreams. I never loved him because I thought he was going to change the world. That wasn't my love. He was my son. And you should never have thought that I loved him more than you because of his ambition. The fact that he's in charge of Egypt, what are the brothers going to think? They didn't like him when he had dreams of being in charge. Now he's running the world. And the brothers, at some point, are thinking, all right, Dad, he's still alive. And yeah, guess what? He's, you know, he's president. And Yaakov says, I don't care. It's never been about the power. It's never been about the impact on the world stage. Yosef Chai, Rav, he says, that's all I need to know. Od Yosef Bnei Chai. Right, that's actually exactly what the Malbim and others say. Bnei Chai, my son, that's all I cared about, that he was my son. And guess what? You're my sons too. I've always loved all of you. And the fact that he was lost, I didn't mourn. Because of the loss of our capacity to exert force on the world stage. I mourn because I lost my son, and that's all I needed to know. But he, Ruach Yaakov Avichem, and his spirit came to life. They went down to Egypt. He sends Judah ahead to go to Goshen. Midrashim abound on why he sent Judah ahead to go to Goshen. Why? So he could set up a Bet Midrash, and they could arrive, and the Siyum Hashas is already taking place when they arrive. Anyone see the pictures of the Siyum HaShas yesterday? I'm sure on Facebook you saw pictures of 90,000 people celebrating the Siyum HaShas. I wonder how many actually did Shas. But I imagine it was quite a few. They had everybody who did it stand up. And quite a few people stood up. But I would have gone, but it'll motivate me. 7.5 years' time. Guess what? That'll be in the summer next year. Next time, rather. 7.5 years. We won't be freezing in MetLife Stadium. But this Shabbos is the Daf base of Brachos, right? We start on Shabbos again. So feel free to jump in. Actually, Surash Leship, we're going to have a special Siyum for the members of the Shul who have done the Siyum HaShas. They're going to finish it. They'll do the Siyum. And then someone will start Brachos again. And everyone is invited to participate. And of course, doing a Daf a day is an immense undertaking. But it's a good time to start doing anything. You want to do a Mishnah day? You want to do a Pasuk a day? A Parsha or something? It's a good time to start a pattern of learning. Yaakov comes down to Egypt. On the way down, he goes to Beersheba to bring Korbanot. What a strange thing to do without explanation. Why Beersheba? What happens in Beersheba? So the Avos repeatedly go to Beersheba. And actually, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has an intriguing reading of why Be'er Sheva was so central to them as the ambition about the Bet Mikdash. And actually what designated Be'er Sheva as special was, strangely enough, the foliage. It was the trees. It was filled with trees. And in the Midrashim, Yaakov stops there not just to bring korbanot, but to do something very specific. He takes seeds of the trees in the area and puts it in his pocket and on his way down to Egypt. Why does he take seeds? He plants trees in Egypt. Why is he planting trees in Egypt? To answer an issue that the commentators are going to have in a few parashiyos time, which is going to be, hold on a minute. After the Exodus, they're going to leave Egypt. And then they're told, now, build a tabernacle, which is going to require an immense amount of deforestation. They're leaving Egypt in the middle of the night with some gold, with some payment. They're schlepping through the sea. They get through the desert. They're at the bottom of a mountain in the middle of a wilderness. And God says, okay, get out the wood. Who's got the memo? Who told us to bring wood? Where are we going to get all this cedar wood to build the Mishkan? And the Ibn Ezra says, there is a tradition, Kabbalah. And he says, and if this is the Kabbalah, I'm not going to argue with it, right? But if this Kabbalah is invented, I'll give a better suggestion. And Ibn Ezra's suggestion is there was an oasis at the bottom of Har Sinai where they were capable of getting trees. That's where the wood came from. But there is a long-standing midrashic rabbinic tradition that wood came from Jacob. When he went to Be'er Sheva, he took seeds and he planted them down in Egypt. And that was a signal of hope, which is odd because literally the term taking root is from trees. He plants seeds, which is almost a signal of permanence. But that's been read by the sages as a signal of transience, that this is just being planted for the function. You're going to need these when you go back. That's the way that Chazal read it, which is an interesting way of actually thinking about our kind of permanence. When we plant roots, is it really a signal that what we're doing, it's not necessarily a signal that we're never going to move, but that we're investing in the future and we'll take with us whatever we get. Yeah.
I have trouble with the idea that the seeds were planted because they were going to need the wood to build the Mishkan. Here they are leaving Egypt, they're going into it, they're crossing the sea, and they're schlepping with them this wood. Why would they be taking wood? They have no knowledge of what's going to be. And you're suddenly taking the time to chop down trees, cut them, take this wood that they're going to use for the Mishkan years later in the desert. That doesn't flow for me.
Yeah, it's going to appeal to different people differently. Again, the Pashtunim, the Ibn Ezra says, he basically bows over and says, if this is Kabbalah, if this is the way it's going to be, I'm not going to argue with it. Tradition's tradition, but it doesn't flow for me either. It doesn't make any sense. And the rationalists, again, in the 19th century, said these rabbis are crazy. It didn't say anything about trees anywhere. There's no hint at this. He goes to Be'er Sheva to bring korbanot. They don't talk about moving trees with them. Yeah, he doesn't say how they got trees. News, there's a lot of gaps that we're not told about. That doesn't mean they didn't think about it. We're just not told about it.
The original travel plan did not call for 40 years. It was a direct route.
So they wouldn't have needed the trees.
Why would they have needed it?
So this is what Yaakov Kamenetsky suggests, that it wasn't about the need. Of course, he could have said, I'm not bringing seeds down because we're going to come straight up. There's going to be no Egel, and we're going to just build from the trees in Eretz Yisrael. The trees were a signal of hope. That's what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says. It wasn't that they needed the wood. Of course, they had the wood in Israel, but actually it was a planting Israeli trees or Canaanite trees, to be more historically accurate at the time, as a signal that this is a temporary stop. Which is, again, why when we have pictures of Yerushalayim in our walls, in our house, when we've got Shaviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, one, Imeshkachech Yerushalayim, these are all signals to us that however rooted, however permanent, there is a hope of a future time when we'll be living a very different kind of life. And that's what these trees were for. They're more of a signal than actually a function. That's where Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky reads it. Okay. Which actually he ties into the whole liturgy of Yom Kippur, which seems to be a lot about korbanot, which can be a bit of a downer for a lot of people in the middle of Yom Kippur. We spend, 15 minutes mumbling quietly about korbanot. Why are we doing that? And his suggestion was that actually it's a long tradition in Jewish history, patriarchal in fact, to try to inspire us with hope of a future time. It's not necessarily achieving anything functionally right now. It's about reminding us of a different age. So Yaakov comes down, sees Yosef, gives him a hug, cries on his shoulder. Very good. Yosef then sets up the agricultural institution of serfdom, where he starts displacing the Egyptians, taking their land, taking their food, and moving everyone around. Okay, so in the remaining 30 seconds, we're going to look at the sheet. It's not really 30 seconds, it's 45 or so. Let's look at the sheet. So this takes us back to the scene. Yosef has revealed himself. This is the fulcrum right in the middle between the two acts. Yosef has revealed himself and he sent his brothers to go up to get Yaakov and bring him down. Vayishalach et achiv. He sent off his brothers, vayelechu, and they went on their way. And he had a parting message. He had three words for his brothers as they began their trip up to Yaakov, now knowing exactly the truth. And he says to them, Vayoma aleihem al tirgazu baderech. How do you translate tirgazu? What is roged?
Angry.
Harm.
Wow.
Harm. Is that what you said? Harm?
Yeah.
So it's been translated in different ways, which is why I ask. Le roged, literally, kind of its core meaning, actually means shake, like to shake, to be unsteady or tremor. And here it's been read, Al tirgazu baderach, do not become quarrelsome en route. Again, you're the brothers. You've just been told that this is your brother who's been gone for 2 decades plus. And he says, go get your father. And also, it's strange to me, none of the commentators note this, but Vishalach et achiv yelechu, he sends them, and they go. They're already going. Vayomalem, and he seems to be, oh, by the way, on the way out, he says, don't fight on the way. How do you read that as brothers? Oh, what nice parting advice. How do you see that as the brothers?
Don't blame each other.
So that's what Yosef is saying. Imagine you're Reuven. Imagine you're God. You're walking along. You're about to go back and tell Yaakov what's happened. And you hear Yosef shout back after you. He's now Prince of Egypt, right? Or whatever he is, the viceroy, a word that no one uses in any context ever. I don't know what that means. He's the vice president of Egypt, whatever he is. He shouts out, oh, by the way, don't fight en route. What do you think? It's like, oh, he loves us. What do you think as a brother? Here he goes. Unbelievable. We haven't seen you in 22 years. And the first thing he does, he says, oh, don't fight. What do you think of us, Yosef? Is that like a message they're now going to kind of on the way home warmly imagine, oh, we've missed him so long. Nothing's changed. That's what it sounds like on the surface, right? That's how I would read it if I were a brother. But then again, we're talking of people of a different stature. That's how I would feel. Tirgazu can also just mean don't be unsteady. In fact, in the first box, and the first Masechta, talking of Siyum HaShas, which, don't worry, I'm nowhere near that. But the first Masechta I did complete was Maseches Tarnit with my rabbi back in England, and this comes up in Maseches Tarnit. Rashi says, Al titasku bedvar halacha. Don't learn halacha. That's what Yosef was telling the brothers. So if you're not inclined towards halacha and you're going home and that's your message, oh great, what a great advice, I like this. So that you shouldn't become unsteady. This is advice, don't get lost. What makes people get lost? You start learning abstractions, getting involved with halachic discussions, you're going to get lost. Focus on the road, right? That's what Yosef's advice is and guidance here. And in fact, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, one of the rabbis, Rav Tabori, said he was once in a car sitting in the back. There were two guys in the front, one of whom was an esteemed rabbi as a passenger, and one was a driver, a student, one of the Talmidim. And what did Talmidim do? In yeshiva for years, you live inside the walls of the Bet Midrash, you're suddenly sitting in a car with one of the a senior, esteemed rabbinic figure. You think, I'm going to ask all the questions that I've been thinking of in my life. This is access to treasure. And the Talmud started asking these questions, and the rabbi in the front seat just says, Al tirgazu baderach, we're not going to talk about this. You're going to get lost. Focus on the road. Says, oh, all right, fine. Focus on the road. Which is, could be he was just tired and like, oh, I don't want to talk about this now. Focus on the road. That's one way to deal with it. In fact, one of the rabbis in Gush said he was on a plane once and someone was getting into it with him. And he said, oh, I've got something. There's a movie. I need to watch the movie. And he put the thing up. So it could just be like, didn't want to sit there for 8 hours having a discussion. And those were in the days when if you didn't put your headphones on at the right moment, you could miss the movie. You didn't get to choose when to play and pause it. Either way. But this is the way that it's been read, and this is a generally accepted view. In fact, so much so, the Rabbeinu Bach and others have to go into detail and say, oh, we're not saying you shouldn't learn Torah. Learning Torah, of course, is amazing. But you shouldn't be doing deep, abstract research on complicated shilas while you're traveling. You're going to lose your way. And in fact, when often I listen to Shirim in the car with my Bluetooth in my ear with this, and at the same time I've got the navigation device telling me where to go, and I'm trying to listen to the Shir, and it's really irritating because navigation takes precedence according to the phone. So it'll often say, oh, please turn right here, which is all I need. But then it gives me the 14 different names of the road that I'm going down. I-35 South, also called FDR Highway, also called this, and then turn right. And I've just missed the crux of the shear because it's overshadowing. So I have to look at it and press back to go back to the main scene. And then I'm at my next turn and I keep missing it. And it's not a sensible way to drive. And maybe that's the instruction. Don't listen to Shirim while you're driving. Yeah.
Maybe Yosef assumed that the first thing they're going to talk about is they're going to argue amongst themselves about the sale of
Yosef. Right. That is exactly where Rashi goes in his third reason, which is strange because that, again, would have instinctively been my first reading of this. He's saying, don't fight. Don't fight, meaning we've all had a nice group hug. We've all got together. We've cried with each other. But as soon as you get out there on the path, he knows, they see he's in power. It's going to be a blame game. Whose fault was this? Who did this? And we're about to go meet our father. Who's going to take the fall? We're going to tell him, oh, Yosef is alive. And he's going to turn and say, hold on a minute. I thought he died. You showed me the thing covered in blood. It's going to, can of worms. And they're imagining the worst case scenario. And Yosef is saying, al tirguzu baderach. Don't fight. Don't fight about this. You're going to start fighting and blaming each other. Don't fight. And actually, that's relatively peaceable, good advice from a brother. It's part of his forgiveness. I'm not holding this over you. Don't worry about the blame. That's what he seems to be saying. That's Rashi's third view. His second view is he's saying, "Al tirguzu baderach," don't become unsteady, meaning this is actually also good advice. It's also from the Gemara in Tanit. He's saying, don't rush home at the expense of your own safety. You've now, I'm sure they've got this news. They can't WhatsApp Yaakov. They're sitting there, I want to be the first to tell him. Our father has been beside himself for 2 decades. His face is going to light up. And Yosef is saying, don't be unsafe. Don't travel in the dark. Don't go down a bad shortcut. Take your time. That's his advice here. But actually, in the third gray box, the Bechor Shor, the Datz Kain, in the Torah, and others suggest that actually what he's saying, Al Tirguzu Baderach, is don't be worried along the way anymore. I've given you 10 wagons full of stuff in the middle of a famine. What should a normal person be worried about walking along the road with 10 wagons? Highway robbery, right? Thieves. And according to the different views, they're all saying, Yosef is saying, which again, almost a rubbing in to a wound, says, trust me, everybody knows me, everybody fears me. Just write, Yosef, just write Viceroy's brother on the side of your wagons, ain't no one going to trouble you. Al tirguzu baderach, don't worry about it, and don't even hesitate to bring down all your stuff when you come down to Egypt. Don't think about hiding your valuables or leaving them at home or leaving in a local bank deposit box. No one's going to touch you. In the words of the Dalai of Canaan, al tiftechu, don't be worried, tifchadu misakanat haderech, don't worry about the trouble along the way. Ki'ani mashal b'chol ha'aretz. I'm the rule of everything. At which point they think, oh, all right, fine, thank you. Yep, here we go again. And the Baal HaTurim actually has a fascinating reading. Al tirguzu baderech, don't become unsteady on the ways. It's actually moral guidance. It says, don't lose your moral guide on the way, and think to yourself, this is almost the inverse actually of the last reading. The last reading was, don't worry, no one's going to attack you on the way, you'll be safe. I'm in charge of everything. The Baal HaTurim says, obviously the brothers knew that. Who wouldn't have put on the side of their thing Viceroy's brother? Imagine your brother or sibling becomes president of the United States, you're going to walk around with those M&Ms with the presidential seal for the rest of your life. You're going to put on one of those pins. You're going to have a little thing on the back of your car. You're not going to hide that fact, right? You're proud. So of course they're going to put that out there. And the Baal HaTurim says, what Yosef's saying is, don't let this go to your head. Al tirguzu, don't lose your way and think, the Viceroy's our brother, I was being very careful on the way down not to trample on people's fields. I was being very deferent to house owners and homeowners. And I was operating like a private citizen who had concerns with civil authority. And he's saying, don't think that because I'm your brother, I'm going to swipe everybody else away. This is not nepotism. This isn't how the world works. Yes, I'm in charge, but there are rules, there are laws. Al terguzeh baderach. Al tismachu alai. Don't rely on me. Lomar tazeh. Achinu gadol baretz. Our brother's a big shot. Lasod aval l'shem adam. We can do whatever we like. Now, brothers, this isn't a mafia operation. That's what Yosef is saying. Yes, I'm your brother, but there are rules, there are laws. This isn't a way out. This isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. That's the way the Bala Tumri is. And the Emek Dava will finish with, the Netziv says, actually, this is general advice. He endorses Rashi's view when he says this is about not fighting. But it's also couched in a way that gives it universal resonance. Al tirguzu baderech is not just, oh, don't fight on the way. He could have said two words. Al tirguzu, don't fight about this. Don't fight about whose fault it is. What's the derech got to do with it? He's saying just don't fight in the room, don't fight in the foyer, don't fight anywhere. But derech means on the way, on life's journey. This is how the Emek Dava reads. On life's journey, al tirguzu, don't quarrel about the past. There are things that have happened and you can fight it out forever. This is the way he reads it. Be'emet, last line, ein mederech ha-chochma, it is unwise, lehitragez ha-masha kfar avar, to be agitated and unsteady and quarrelsome and aggressive about what's happened. That doesn't mean we should just let bygones be bygones, never think about the past, but it's no point relitigating the past every 3 seconds. And that's Yosef's guidance to his brothers. And this is, again, that general principle of forgiveness. This is the first time the word forgive appears in the Chumash, which is why the brothers are so suspicious. This isn't how the ancient world operates. Who's the only person to forgive anybody so far in biblical history? God. God is the only figure capable of forgiveness, it seems, on the surface. And the brothers are so suspicious. And Yosef's lesson is, Al tirguzu baderech, he's almost the model of pardon and clemency and mercy. And about how to build a future. He says, you want to know the key to success? Yosef says, you want to understand how I got here? This is not just guidance preaching down, but advice to lift them up. You want to become great? Al tirguzu baderech. Don't be relitigating the past. I could have been sitting in jail for the last 22 years thinking to my head, oh, if only I had said that, if only I had done that. And I maybe I'm speaking for myself, but often when we have hostile moments, we relitigate it in our mind. Even small things, driving along the road and someone does something aggressive to you or to me, to one will spend the journey thinking, oh, I wish I'd said that. I wish in that moment I'd had exactly the right word. We relitigate it and it holds us back. It keeps us down. And the advice he gives is, Al tirguzu baderech. You want to get big? Not forget about, but don't relitigate it every 3 seconds. And last week we said Menashe was called Menashe because he said, thank you, God, for Nashani, letting me forget about the traumas of my past. And obviously he doesn't forget in the literal sense. He knows all about the history, but letting me let go. That's what lets him succeed. And that's the advice I've been given. I'm going to resist the temptation to tie everything in to the current moment. But I'm going to leave everything with you to think about that. And I don't want to relitigate everything 15 times. We'll talk more in Shabbat. You should feel free to reach out to me as well if you'd like to. I know a lot of people feel the need to do something or want to do something or see somebody do something or say something, which is perfectly natural right now. And that'll happen. But in the meantime, I wish you all a good Shabbos. And I'll see you next week.